Hi, this is Tamsin Granger.
And this is Dan Abuhoff.
With Tamsin and Dan Read the Paper, it's January 7th, 2018. It's Dan Abuhoff's birthday. Happy birthday, Dan.
Thank you. Thank you, Tamsin. And it's also our first broadcast of the new year. So there's a lot of big events, a lot of big events that we have in mind as we do today's broadcast. And perhaps one of the biggest things that's on the calendar coming up is Monday is the battle, Monday night, for the collegiate national championship in football, or is it? Is it?
May I just say, yes, before you get started, that I called my mother today, who is 92 years old, and one of the things she said to me was, how about that Rose Bowl?
Well, the whole country. And by definition now, is focused on the fact that we've had the two semi-games leading to the national championship. And the two Titans that are going to do battle on Monday night are the University of Georgia and the University of Alabama. And yet, even though they're being it's being billed as the battle for number one, there's an argument that it's not. There's a school called Central Florida, which claims to be the national championship. Central Florida, that's right. And you're saying to yourself, this is a joke. This is a gimmick. This can't be true. No, there's a lot to it. Central Florida is a smaller school that's developed a big-time football program. They had huge success this year. Their coach, Scott Frost, was so successful, he got to move on to a bigger school. He's moving on to the University of Nebraska next year. But this year, what he accomplished for Central Florida was a record of 13-0. That means of all the schools in the football division of NCAA, there's only one school undefeated. It's Central Florida.
But who'd they play?
Who'd they play, you say to yourself. That's exactly the right question. If they played Lilliputians, if they played nobody formidable, it doesn't mean anything. Except for one thing. Except for one thing. Central Florida played a bowl game. And no one talked about them being the national champion until they played the bowl game. It was called the Peach Bowl. I'm sure your mother caught it. They played a school called Auburn.
Ooh.
And here's the amazing thing. They beat Auburn. They beat them 34-27.
Not too shabby.
But they beat 34-27, and it wasn't even that close. I watched the game, and here is the funniest thing. You know what Auburn beat this year? Auburn beat the University of Georgia this year.
Ooh, interesting.
And you know who else Auburn beat this year? They beat the University of Alabama.
Oh, my.
And you know who beat Auburn? Central Florida. And Central Florida is undefeated. So they claim that they are the national champions.
But maybe it was a quirk.
No, there's no quirk. No more quirky than anything else that happens on the football field. And they're serious about it. How serious are they? They paid the coaches of the team, including the assistant coaches, a bonus. The bonus that's associated with winning the national championship. They paid money on it because they consider themselves the national champion. And in fact, today there hangs a large banner in the central administrative offices of Central Florida that says National Champions 2017. So you can watch that game. Your mother can watch Alabama play Georgia on Monday, and that's for the number two school in the country. It's Central Florida, number one. So there's that. The other big football story that we noticed this week in the college ranks was unfortunately an obituary. And it was the obituary of Karam Khaza. Karam Khaza was the coach for many, many years of Yale. And one might say, well, gee, how important is that? Yale University, is that big time football? He had a lot of success at Yale. And he had even more than success, he had a lot of publicity for that program at Yale. They had a number of years where they dominated the Ivy League. As the obituary notes, the most famous year was happened to be a year in which they went undefeated, but their last game was a game in which they had a two-touchdown lead in Harvard, lost the lead, ended up a tie, and the Harvard Crimson ran a headline which said Harvard beats Yale 29-29. That was the heyday of, in some ways, Ivy League football in the last 20 or 30 years, or maybe more, 40 or 50 years. And one of the reasons that the programs were so well-known even then, even though people were on to the fact it wasn't the best football, was because at the same time that Yale was playing that famous game against Harvard, and they had Calvin Hill, who became a huge star in the NFL for the Dallas Cowboys, come later, they also had a someone at school called Gary Trudeau. Gary Trudeau was, really? Was not on the football team.
That sounds familiar.
Yes, but he wasn't on the football team. Gary Trudeau was actually a cartoonist, or a budding cartoonist. He did some stuff for the Yale publications, but he also got a regular gig in the Yale Daily News. And he had a regular feature in which he parodied the life of the quarterback of the Yale football team, Brian Dowling.
Or parodied or satirized?
No, whatever. Whatever. I don't know what the difference is here. But in any event, let's call it satirized. And he referred to him regularly as BD. And he had sort of fictional life of Brian Dowling. And that became, for those of you who read the comic strip, will recognize the central character in Doonesbury. And that led to a lot of publicity around the Yale program. Well, in any event, Carmen Casa had great success, but not always. When he first took over at Yale, and the story that appears in the obituary in the Times says this, that they had an inauspicious debut, a loss to Connecticut, and Yale's information director remarked that Casa had received a telegram from the Alumni Association saying, "There's a train leaving for New York at 4 o'clock. Be under it." So, you know, he stuck with it, though.
Yeah, he stuck with it.
And he had a fair bit of success.
It sounds like his players had a fair bit of success also.
Yeah.
That they went on to...
Well, he used to say that. That's the standard thing. They all became doctors and lawyers. You know, I don't buy into that entirely. I'd like to see the numbers on that. I think a lot of them became ex-college football players. But whatever. Yeah, you don't really know. The other thing, before I yield the floor to Tams and get off sports for just a minute, was there was a huge hockey game that was played this past week, again, associated
the
with
Winter
New Year's.
The Winter Classic?
The Winter Classic. Tams is the hockey expert of the two of us. Tamsin was the one who played ice hockey in college. So she knows more about this sport than I do. But I do know they played it in Citi Field. So it's outdoors. Again, hockey generally indoors when it comes to the NHL, as you well know.
And pretty small venues in comparison with a lot of sports venues.
Right, yeah. Even if you have Madison Square Garden, you're talking about 19,000 people at the most. When they play outdoors, as they do around New Year's, one game they do this, they have an enormous amount of people. It's 41,000 people. And as a result, the hockey players really go for it. You might think they'd complain about the cold or the unfamiliar setting.
And this year was super cold.
It was about 20 degrees the entire time. And yet, the hockey players love being in front of this huge crowd. But the odd thing about it is...
But they also love being outdoors, because it's like back in the day when they were growing up in Canada.
Right, in Hamilton.
Playing outside.
Yeah. But here's the thing that struck me as bizarre. And they show a picture. It was so cold that the beer that was being sold by the vendors froze. They have a picture of two cans of beer frozen and having burst open. So you have, and this I would have thought never possible, 40,000 hockey fans sitting to the end of a hockey game without beer, which is unbelievable to me. I mean, for those of you who have never had the opportunity to see a long line outside a men's restroom at any venue, because you think it's just the women's restroom. It's not. If you go to a hockey game in Madison Square Garden at the end of the second period, there is a line going around the whole corridor to get into that restroom between the second and third period.
And you think it's the beer, not the Yoo-Hoo or the Mountain Dew.
I'm guessing it's the beer.
All right.
But it's not what goes on at Citi Field when they play outdoors. So hats off to the hockey fans who sat there at 20 degrees all the way without a drink. Very impressive.
Well, I was flipping through the... newspaper and noticed a review of Hamilton.
Mm-hmm.
And well, you think Hamilton's been reviewed enough, probably.
Enough.
But this is
enough
Hamilton.
To last us a lifetime.
Well,
yes.
This is the company that's opened in London. And the review was in the New York Times by Ben Bradley, mm-hmm. Brantley, the New York Times drama critic, whatever, theater critic. And it is a rave.
Really?
It is a rave.
More so than the regular Hamilton.
The title of it is Hamilton Conquers London.
Yeah.
And it especially calls out the lead, the guy who plays Hamilton, Jamel Westman, who has a fabulous voice, apparently. Mm-hmm. And he, Brantley, intimates he might even be better than the original Hamilton, our beloved Lin-Manuel Miranda. Brantley also mentions that the score gets richer every time I hear it.
Mm-hmm.
And he does say that some of the other players are great. The women playing the Schuyler sisters, Eliza and Angelica, are very good, but of course can't compare to the incomparable Philippa Sue and Renee Elise Goldberg. So, and also, I mean, who can do better than Davee Diggs at Thomas Jefferson? Right, right, right. But it does get an extraordinary view. Apparently, the people go crazy about the George III character.
Well, I was just going to say, how does that play? Because
they think it's hilarious. They like it? Yeah. He says it really tickled the audience.
That's funny, because not everyone would take it in stride like that. And, you know, kudos to the English, because it's not really directed toward the... you know, to praise of the English government. But great.
Well, it was a while ago, Dan. So we also noticed an article about a Bobby Darin show.
Yeah. You know, Bobby Darin is kind of an interesting figure. You know, he had a wide range of styles that he was able to sing, and some think he was very slick. He was certainly very successful. He died at a young age, which sort of adds to the legend.
He had heart problems.
Heart problems that I knew about from a young age, and he was sort of racing against time. And there have been various biopics and attempted biopics of him throughout the years. But they have sort of, what's it called, the Lyric and Lyricist series.
At the 92nd Street Y in New York.
And he's not a lyricist, and he didn't write any lyrics. But somehow they've kind of edged them in there. And they're putting.
And who's the guy starring in it?
Jonathan Groff, about Hamilton. He was the guy who played King George in the Broadway production. Yeah. And he's a big name in this. So it's a serious effort.
I don't know if we'll get to see it.
No.
Because it's pretty sold out.
Yeah, and it's a small
venue.
And
after this article, it's probably going to be
the kind of thing that they're testing for Broadway.
We like Bobby Darin.
We're big Bobby Darin fans. We have to come clean on that. You know, I think some people might initially say, oh, isn't that a little commercial? A little, superficial, whatever. And the answer is no. We like Bobby Darin a lot. We have two particular albums that we love. If you get your hands on it, you'd be forced to do it.
And the kids love too. It's kind of a family favorite. Right. Is Darin at the Copa.
Darin at the Copa. That is a live Las Vegas performance. So you're saying, wow, that's super slick. Who'd be interested in that? But he puts it over and he's great. You know, it's all the standards. It's Smack the Knife and all that stuff. But
And when he's hectoring the audience at a certain point,
it's
not like the drunken Sinatra.
No. He's even speaking Yiddish at some point. The guy's got no business speaking Yiddish. I think Bubba is out there. And
the other one we love is Two of a Kind.
Two of a Kind. Now that used to be a collector's item. Can we call it a collector's item?
I mean, it's an obscure album.
It's an obscure album.
It is Johnny Mercer and Bobby Darin.
Right. Johnny Mercer.
And it's a great album cover.
Just to be clear, Johnny Mercer, great songwriter. Great songwriter.
Right. And darn good singer.
Well, any good singer. Southern accent. You hear him once in a while singing his own songs. And this was, and Johnny Mercer, not necessarily exactly the kind of songs that you'd associate with Bobby Darin.
So he's the older guy. Standard. Bobby Darin is young and hip.
And the back and forth between the two of them.
The chemistry is amazing.
It's an unbelievable album.
We came across this listening to Jonathan Schwartz.
Right.
Had to be 40 years ago.
No, don't say that. It was a long time ago.
At least 35 years ago.
Exactly. It was.
And
You can't say 40 years ago. It's my 39th birthday. How could it be 40 years
And ago? You somehow... We heard cuts from it.
Oh, that's right.
And I found the
album.
You found the album at the Lambertville...
Golden Nuggets, whatever.
The Lambertville
flea
marketplace.
It's the greatest find in my life. For $5, I bought the LP. Guess what happens? 8 years later, they invented something called compact discs. And everything got re-recorded on. And any fool can buy this now. So you should go out there, all listeners, buy Two of a Kind. You'll love it. So we're Bobby Darin fans. So there you have. So if you get a chance to see this at 92nd Street Y, God bless you. But I'm telling you, you're going to see this on Broadway, I believe. Don't you think?
Really?
Yeah.
I don't think this particular thing.
I bet on it. All right. So January seems to be a month for obituaries. And, you know, it gets cold and people have been hanging on for the holidays and perhaps they don't. But in any event, Brendan Byrne passed away. And Brendan Byrne was the governor of New Jersey when we were in school. And he's a Princeton alum, and there was some association with Princeton when he was there. And he was always thought of as a sort of a credible, principled guy, right? Democratic governor.
He's kind of a consummate politician. But I should say, you worked a party at Brendan Byrne's house. We both worked at the dining halls of Princeton. And when reunions would come around, we'd sign up to work reunions. Reunions is always the week between the end of school and graduation.
Right.
And I clearly remember you going off in your best possible clothes to work a party at the governor's mansion.
That's a whole other subject. Because
it would have been one of his big, his 25th.
Well, this is how we figured it out. They say he graduated 1979, so we said...
1979?
No, he graduated 1949. So we said to ourselves, what year was this? And Tamsin says, of course, it was his 25th reunion, 25 plus 1949. It was 1974. And that's clearly correct.
Yeah.
So it was 1974. I was there with the governor. I'm not mentioned in the obituary, notwithstanding my outfit.
6 degrees of separation
And then I walked to the wedding that Tamsin and I attended there. But in any event, it turns out more than we realized, Brendan Byrne was a pretty funny guy. They have some quotes attributed. I'll just give you a couple of them. And it's kind of odd. They said he has an odd personality. Sometimes he seemed quite diffident and didn't have much to say. And sometimes he was remarkably disarming and clever. So he said, for example, at one point, there was a poll that showed 96% of the people knew who I was. And 4% thought I was doing a good job. Okay? You know, this is a very formidable guy. It doesn't sound anything like him. Again, accomplishments, New Jersey income tax, saved the Pine Barrens, things like that. He was a liberal. He was progressive. Here's another one. It's not true that I, Brendan Byrne, can only read at a fifth grade level. I read out-of-state papers, too. So there you have it. And finally, the quote that they have here that they end the obituary with, which is associated with an acknowledgement that he was, in fact, getting on his years. In years, he said recently, remember that stuff they put in our food during World War II to prevent us from getting excited about girls? It's beginning to work.
So, all right. Go, Brendan.
Yeah, so there you go. Brendan Byrne. There was an article about, just a graphic, really, in the Times about the increased participation of international athletes in sports over the last, 40, 50, 60 years. And some of it's obvious and some of it's surprising, right? So if you look at baseball, for example, it's no surprise that you see a real increasing demographic of Dominican Republic, Puerto Rican, Venezuelan players in the major leagues in baseball. And so much so that they comprise together maybe 25% of the players in Major League Baseball. In the NBA, you see increasing participation of European athletes. And now only 75% of NBA players are U.S., and that's a change, although it's still 75%. Canada, by the way, is the country you focus on for the NHL. For those who don't know this, the National Hockey League, National stands for Canada. It's not U.S. It's a Canadian league.
All right. Okay. Yeah.
And when right now, let me just say that when I was growing up and following the NHL, there were, I think, 3 players from the U.S. in the entire NHL. And if you look at these statistics during that time period, you see it's almost entirely Canadian. Now it's changed enough where you have Swedish, Czech, Finnish, former Soviet Union players. You have a whole bunch of U.S. players. The league now, for the first time, is less than 50% Canadian.
Oh, really?
Which is a huge sea change. But what's interesting to me also is this. Football. Football.
I would think football was all American.
It's all American. And it's so much so that they say the composition of the league, as far as U.S. versus non-U.S., is the same now as it was during the Kennedy administration. And that's surprising for 2 reasons. Number one, when you watch the game, you notice some players that seem to have international names, but apparently there are not enough of them to make a difference in terms of the statistics. But secondly, why is that? Why is that? Why is that that you see so many European players who are getting into the NBA, but not in the NFL? Why is it that you see so many players from the Dominican Republic, Puerto Rico, Venezuela, getting into Major League Baseball, but not into the NFL? I'm not sure why that is. There was such a thing as NFL Europe. It wasn't terribly successful, but they still play games in Europe. There are followers in Europe. The Sky Network shows NFL games in England. And it's not like there are people who don't have that body type in the U.S., in the U.K. or in other European nations. There are big people there. So I'm kind of surprised. I don't understand.
I think they're just too smart. You know, it's not, you know, visually, if you're watching football and you have no idea what the rules are, it doesn't really present very elegantly. It seems like a bunch of guys just crashing into each other. It doesn't have the finesse of European football, which would be soccer, etc. So maybe it, you know, just doesn't conjure up any allure. Why would I want to do that?
I don't know. I am surprised. That's all I can say. But, I mean, that's a sport that probably not to its benefit is resisting all international participation, and that sets it apart from all other sports. I guess it's the U.S. sport.
All right. Museum update.
Museum up. Ding, 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 as we say.
Oh, you got the ding, ding today.
Yeah, exactly.
Right, lucky you.
It's my birthday.
All right. So probably everybody already knows that the Met has announced they will change their admissions policy. If you can prove you're from New York, you can still pay what you want. Mm-hmm. But if you're not from New York, you'll have to pay the required fee.
$25.
Right. I think children under 12 still get in free or something.
But they don't want to be there.
There's a lot of discussion about whether this is good or bad. You know, we've been over that before. But I was just kind of amused. They printed a discussion, a back and forth in the New York Times between Holland Cotter and Roberta Smith, two of the art critics of the Times. And it's just kind of fun. And they get into all the sort of social, political connotations of having this kind of policy. Cotter saying, well, it's, you know, it's kind of an invasion of privacy and, you know, demanding that people present identification to prove that they are from New York and so on. And Smith is very much of the idea that the arts should be available to everyone, that there's an exclusivity that this creates, that, you know, so only wealthy people are welcome here. Only people willing to pay the freight are welcome into our museum, which really goes back. I mean, that, you know, museums were never designed, I think, for the general public. I mean, they're built like these foreboding mansions that you don't feel comfortable going in. And of course, the rich people feel comfortable going in because they're raised that way and they're raised in those places. So I get that. And, you know, that's a little bit of a concern. And she refers to the continual degrading and privatization of public space. So it's kind of a fun discussion. And we'll see what happens. I still don't get it. I go to the Met and it's just jam-packed with people. So where's the darn money going?
Well,
Smith brings that up as well. She says this seems, the additional funds they're going to get by raising this seem minuscule.
Yeah. You know what the real, there are a lot of ways to put this issue. I think you're right. I think they're kind of screwing up with their finances. I don't think this is a solution. And I think a lot of the objections come from the perspective that they already have a huge tax break, that they're partly financed, the museum is partly financed by the city itself. And that's the logic to allowing city dwellers to continue to go for free, because they're paying...
Well, not for free, but for whatever...
Whatever they want, but not to have a fee imposed on them, because they're already paying for it through their taxes. So they're making a different kind of contribution. It's not too different when you think about it, to the debate about deducting local taxes from federal taxes.
So do you not have a problem with people from outside the state having to pay?
I don't feel strongly about it either way. I mean, I don't. It's not to me a real hot button issue. I wouldn't do it, frankly. I would leave it the way it is, because I don't think it makes that big a difference. I think it's all facial for something. It's superficial. I don't know what the real agenda is, but I struck by the debate, by the inability of the two people involved in the so-called debate to really focus on the issue, to get off on things like it has to do with nativist issues. It's really wrong to ask people for their IDs. Isn't that an immigration issue? Say, no, we're talking about $25. Focus. And you know, it just, they seem to just to get a little lost in the whole thing. I also don't view privatization as the equivalent of degrading something, which is the undercurrent there. It's a great public institution. Don't degrade it by privatizing it, in a sense. So they lose me completely. But my guess is they know a lot about art, so it's all good. They can continue to write on whatever they want to write
about. All right. So another obituary that caught my eye is that of Eugene Faw, art collector and dealer.
Yeah.
And actually, he has a pretty interesting story. He grew up in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. His dad was a heat contractor. His mom, a school teacher.
Right.
He graduated from DeWitt Clinton High School.
Oh, well, isn't that where your dad went? That is, yeah.
My dad graduated before. So he's not one of those dealers or collectors that comes from great money.
Right.
And he even mentions that really what it takes is education and sort of hard work. More than anything, not necessarily money. And so he actually sets up his own gallery when he first starts out. And his father helps him finance it. It's over the Oak Room in the Algonquin.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, he had gone to school outside of Washington in Annapolis. And so he's familiar with the museums down there. But when he came back to New York, he studied with some of the greats at Columbia, Millard Meese, Meyer Shapiro, etc. He really had a great foundation. But, you know, he starts out small with this little business making money. And at a certain point, he marries his gallery assistant, who suggests, you know, some of these things you really like, maybe you should just keep them.
Mm-hmm.
And that's when he starts becoming a collector. And he develops great collections that are all over the place now, including a great drawing collection at the Morgan and... you know, oh, here's one interesting thing. He became a consummate salesman.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the ways he did that, one of his tricks for doing that, or mm-hmm. one of the tools he learned from others, was to take his clients to visit a conservator. And he would have the conservator demonstrate how, with removing a little varnish off of these old, dull-looking old masters, mm-hmm. and they had the potential to be much more. And boom, the person was sold on that.
Yeah.
So he was an interesting guy who amassed quite a collection. And even... started a foundation based on the sale of one Van Gogh painting.
Really?
Yeah. Interesting and sad loss there. Let me just mention, you know, that I left out one good quote from Thaw. And he did give away many of his collections.
Yeah.
And what he remarked about that was, after I've owned them and learned about them, the works of art, I don't need them. They're with me and I can give them away. So that's a lesson to be learned by some of us hoarders.
All right. There was an article in the Times about something that was kind of unexpected. Low power radio, something I didn't know too much about, nothing terribly about. These are low power FM radio stations that...
Who cares? I mean, really.
No one's
listening to radio.
Well, I agree that they're not getting much listenership.
I mean, we listen to radio. Well, why would you start a radio station now?
This is... here's what it is. Take it for what it's worth. They're low-power FM stations that can be heard typically for about 3.5 miles, which is like nothing, right? And they are basically community centers, if you will. They become... areas which attract people broadcasting about their community, events in their community, causes in their community, things that people in that area want to talk about. They are not surprisingly growing very much in the Northwest, which is sort of a touchy-feely area who would develop these kind of things. You see 5 or 6 in Seattle. You see 5 or 6 in Portland. And they have odd things, the subject of what they're talking about. One station in Seattle invites listeners to phone their dreams and fantasies into a recorded line, puts them on the air if they're not indecent. Another station in Portland has Russian-speaking residents who just speak Russian on the air. Again, a very small station. Here's my favorite. There's one which, this is Northwest Seattle, has a show where a five-year-old boy chats with his father at bedtime about dinosaurs, music, and sometime bothersome sisters. So this is kind of very local radio, very small town appeal, and they raise money in the way you'd expect in church suppers and the like, and yet the number of these stations is growing. So, you know, it's hard to explain it. It's not for everybody, but low wattage FM stations.
Well, why would you do that instead of a podcast?
Because the way they differentiate it is this way, and some of them, frankly, are augmented by internet radio station feeds. You could do podcasts, possibly, but their point is that the other medium, through the internet, has the potential to reach a whole bunch of people. And by virtue of that, it doesn't have the necessary cabined local connection. This can only be local. It's local from the beginning. It's local from the outside. There's nothing that go to anybody out of 3.5 miles. And because you have those restrictions, it changes the character of what they're doing. Maybe for the better, maybe for not. But it becomes the local community.
So now, is that what you want to do?
No.
You think we should give up all this podcast nonsense?
No, we'd have to move to Portland. And we'd have to speak Russian or something like that. But listen, we have universal appeal. We have to live with that. So that's why we have listeners across the world. So there was another person who passed away that we wanted to speak about. It was a woman named Maura Jacobson, who was an ingenious creator of crossword puzzles at the time. Neither of us are big puzzle doers, but it's a very impressive obituary they have here about her, a very thoughtful approach to puzzles.
I liked her story as well. I mean, she's not an immediate success.
Right.
She ends up, she's laid up from some kind of injury.
Right.
And she works on a few puzzles. She sends puzzles into the Times editor during that period, who sends them back and says, well, you need to work on these a little bit more. She chugs away, and she becomes quite skilled.
Well, apparently, according to the Times, she was the crossword puzzle superstar, or a superstar.
Yeah, we don't know this because we're not puzzle people.
Because we're not puzzle people. And she also was accessible in a sense. She says that she would generally make the clues for the upper left of the grid, where most solvers start a puzzle, unintimidating. Mm-hmm. So as not to discourage people, and she took care...
Kind of suck you in.
Exactly, and she took care not to have two unfamiliar words cross each other, so a solver could figure out a strange word by default. And she has they have some clever puzzles they talk about where she uses words as they might have been pronounced by Elmer Fudd. They also give...
one famous example that really, I'm not sure we can... adequately recreate, but you know, if you're interested, go to the obit of Maura Jacobson in the New York Times.
It's one of those thematic puzzles, and it's clever beyond belief. But anyway, that's Maura Jacobson, who passed away at 91.
And the Times also mentions you know, with puzzles in mind. I mean, they have a section in the Times called Wordplay that involves puzzles, etc. And they give you some tips about Greek gods and characters you should know, that would be helpful to know if you're doing a lot of crossword puzzles.
Right, because sometimes they're very short words and are useful in puzzles.
Yeah, and so they give you a list of ones you should know. And so, you know, I always like to look at lists of Greek gods and goddesses. They start out with Ajax, okay, from the Trojan War. And you know, he's a big galoop is what he is. He's like the biggest warrior in the on the Greek side of the Trojan War. And they say he fell on his sword because he was so disappointed not to get Achilles' armor. When Achilles dies and he and Odysseus are kind of fighting over it, Odysseus gets it.
Oh, really?
You know, that's not exactly what happens.
No?
He is tremendously upset, and he goes out and he decides he's going to kill all the Trojans himself. And what he does is kills a bunch of sheep in a meadow. He's so mortified that then he commits suicide because he's done such a stupid thing.
But
they also mention Eos Arato, the muse of love poetry, Eros, also known as Cupid, Hera, Mrs. Zeus, okay, protector of women. We could use Hera now, and goddess of marriage, which is just kind of funny because her marriage wasn't the simplest, wasn't the most linear. It had some challenges, okay? Right. Zeus often stepped out, shall we say.
All right, well.
You know, he's famous for having dalliances with all kinds of women, especially mortals, okay? But here's the thing about being a god. If you're a god, you can't appear to a mortal in your godly divine state, or bad things will happen. Hence you have, you know, Leda and the swan. That's Zeus appearing to Leda as the swan. And Europa and the bull, okay? The one I find most despicable, Danae and the shower of gold, which kind of, to me, has connotations of what women really want, which would be gold,
right,
between their legs, not a man. And so the most famous one is, of course, Zeus and Semele. You familiar with this story?
Are we still talking about crossword puzzles?
Well, this is a great story. I should just tell you this story.
Yeah, go ahead.
Because it's really kind of fantastic.
No one's using Semele in the puzzle, but go ahead.
Well, they should,
yeah.
You know. Anyway, Semele is having an affair. Zeus is attracted to this mortal.
I do know this story.
Semele.
Go ahead, yeah.
Have I told it to you before?
Yes, you have.
All right, then
No.
Have I told it on the podcast?
No.
Okay. So anyway, Zeus and Semele hit it off. Semele and, of course, Hera is miffed, right? And so Hera changes herself into, appears to Semele like at the, you know, the well or whatever, in the guise of an old woman. And Semele takes her into her confidence, says, "You won't believe who I'm sleeping with. It's Zeus." And Hera says, "Are you sure? You know, because that might be bad. I mean, it could just be some guy who's telling you he's Zeus."
Yeah.
And, you know, that could be awkward.
Right.
So, you know, you should really find out if it's really Zeus.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. And Semele says, "Really? You think so? He has a beard." And Hera says, "Nah, you know, you should find out." And so the next time Zeus comes around, Semele says, "Zeus, could you, you know, I'd like to, you know, see you the way you really are." And he says, no can do, sweetie. And she says, "Oh, come on, Zeusy, please.
Yeah.
And of course, there's a certain point at which I think we all know, a man will do anything to proceed. And Zeus says, "Oh, okay." And he does appear to her in his godly state. And Semele explodes into a million bits.
Well, that's...
But meanwhile...
I'm sure there's a lesson to be learned in that, yes.
Things had proceeded far enough that there has been a conception. And Zeus reaches up as Semele is exploding, grabs a fetus, sticks it in his thigh, carries it for 9 months, and boom, Dionysus is born.
Okay, well, you'll never get Dionysus in a puzzle as far as I'm concerned, but it's good to know just in case that story comes up as a clue.
And you should also know they say Niobe, Medea, satyr. I mean, everybody knows what a satyr is. Half man, half goat. Or is that all men?
The last story we have before we get to our close is about a factory town in China, which is called Sedanko, which, strangely enough, produces more saxophones than anybody else. Which doesn't
really
make a lot of sense. It doesn't make a lot of sense because... China kind of outlawed the saxophone in the late 40s. They thought it was decadent, bourgeois, capitalist. You get the idea. In 1978, things opened up a little bit in China, but you had really no background for any saxophone music and the like. And yet, as a matter of manufacturing, they started making saxophones in the Sedanko. And believe it or not, they just started blowing through the thing, and they kind of liked the sound it made.
There were so many around.
There were many
finally
around.
Started playing.
Well,
them.
The problem is they had a bunch of saxophones and no saxophone teachers. So they had these things. They're blowing on them. They're figuring out, it's an interesting sound. They're trying to make something out of some Japanese folk tunes that they've got that might go on the saxophone. As YouTube develops, they get some instruction by virtue of watching some YouTube stuff. And they developed a little bit of a saxophone cult there. They don't only make it, but they play it. Some people talk about going out in the morning and playing the saxophone as the sun goes up. Some people talk about listening to Kenny G, apparently. Kenny G, apparently you can't close a shopping mall, Zdenko, or a lot of areas in China, without them playing Closing Time by Kenny G. So that's what's going on in China. They're totally into the saxophone. And if they get some more teachers on there, out there, they're going to start playing jazz. Right now, they say they can't because it's just too hard. And we will close on a story which combines two of our themes today, which is sports and music, and it's the Philadelphia 76ers. The Philadelphia 76ers, it turns out, have a theme song. And when I say it turns out, for this reason. They developed a theme song in the 70s when they were a good team and they had Julius Erving and stuff like that. And it was developed by a bunch of guys who were just in PR, and the owner said, you guys play guitar, can you make a theme song? And it sort of sounds like something a bunch of guys like that might do. They didn't get, you know, they weren't successful in the music business. A lot of them, one of them got into window treatments and the like. And yet the song kind of, you know, hung on for a little bit, then petered out, and it was resurrected 2 years ago. They decided, hey, this is retro, this is great, this is disco.
Well, didn't they normally play it when they were winning?
Well, they hadn't played it.
They weren't winning that much?
They hadn't played it for years. They brought it back 2 years ago, and they decided they would play it whenever they won a home game. But the problem is 2 years ago, they only won 10 games all season, and about three or four of them were home. So no one knew they had resurrected it. So now they're starting to win, and they've kind of, they're resurrecting it. And it's popular. They start the story talking about T.J. McConnell, reserve guard, got married. And he said, you know, as soon as they finished the ceremony, his brother and the best man got the orchestra to light up the lyrics, to light up the song, and everybody was singing and dancing and going crazy. The players love it, and it's kind of catchy. Here it is. So you'll get it soon enough. It's basically 1, 2, 3, 4, 5 Sixers. Here come the Sixers. The idea. For Philadelphia, 76ers, stomping feet. All right, so groove on that, and that's the end of our podcast today. From Tamsin and Dan, read the paper.
Yeah. See you next week. Here they come, Philadelphia, on the run, stand up and cheer, number one, Philadelphia. Sixers. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, Sixers.